Okay, Mr. Redding. Get your materials together there. There's no huge hurry. Before you begin, so we've agreed on a good suggestion of counsel that these two arguments be consolidated, and I think that's a good idea, and I understand that both sides have agreed on that. As you know, had we originally set this as a consolidated argument, we would be allowing 30 minutes per side, but since we hadn't told you about that in advance, technically you have the total amount of 40 minutes a side, but we strongly urge you, and I'm sure I speak for my colleagues here, that it's not necessary and probably wouldn't be beneficial to your client for either side to try to use the full 40 minutes, so I hope that you'll be efficient in making your arguments and not feel that you owe it to your clients in any way to use the full time that's allotted. With that understanding, Mr. Redding, we'll hear from you.
Thank you, Your Honor, and I'd like to thank the court for allowing us to combine these at the last minute. As to using up the full 40 minutes, let me just say that I hope not to. On the other hand, there are extremely complex issues in these cases.
That's fine, but we also have extensive briefings, so
yes,
understand you don't waive anything that's in your brief, and there's a lot
and
there.
I've done enough oral arguments that I'd just as soon not be up here any longer than I
okay.
have to.
All right.
Thank you, Your Honor. Your Honor, I'd like to start out with a discussion of how 7422H applies in these cases. And I believe there the distinction is important as to the difference between the two appeals. The one appeal is partners who entered into individual settlements with the IRS.
The Irving Group settled and the Kircher Group didn't.
Absolutely.
Okay.
Yes, Your Honor.
Irvine.
And because of that, the Irving Group very clearly matches what was tried in many ways in Wiener. And we agree with the judge as to the merits of the penalty interest issue that if it is reached, Wiener should prevail and that it should be reached. But the 7422H argument.
So to reach the issue in Irvine, we have to find that we have jurisdiction or that the district court had jurisdiction to decide whether the TMT determination was made in the partnership.
Yes, Your Honor.
At the minimum.
Yes, Your Honor.
Okay.
And, in fact, I believe that is the core question in 7422H in both categories of cases, the difference being that in Duffy, the court held that what we were asking it to do went beyond that. It did that in Duffy. It didn't treat 7422H as barring that inquiry. But it held that there had been a TMT determination in the docketed case in the cases subject to the decision. Wiener held that the FPAW did not constitute a TMT determination for purposes of the settled partners. We agree with that. And I would note that the Fifth Circuit, I think, is fairly clear on that. The Federal Circuit has seemed to follow a different approach, but I note that in the decision that just came out in Bush, The Federal Circuit has now said, we've looked back at Keener and Pratty and recognized that the court did, in fact, make that determination, that in every case there had been a TMT determination. And in Bush, it interpreted that as exercising the court's jurisdiction to determine jurisdiction. But
okay,
either way you interpret it.
If we were to conclude that 7422H does not prevent us from looking at whether a TMT determination was made in the partnership level proceeding, then in Kircher, we would have to say that this finding of lacking economic substance and so on and so forth is not a TMT determination. I mean, that's the merits analysis there, right?
Yes, Your Honor. It's also,
if it
in a
is
sense,
a
jurisdictional.
TMT
yes.
determination, your guys are done. Right?
Yes, Your Honor.
Limitations and all
exactly.
Limits.
Yes, Your Honor. The difference between this case and Duffy and where we would distinguish it, and I would note that in Varela, the court made this distinction too. The court looked at that language in the decision and held that it constituted two determinations. One, that it lacked economic substance, the transactions lacked economic substance, and that was enough to be the equivalent of a sham determination. Whether I agree with that or not, I accept that that's this court's position on that now. But it also treated the substantial distortion of income as a second ground. And in Duffy, the court interpreted that as an independent TMT. Thus, there were two TMTs and nothing else. The actual TMT related to substantial distortion of income actually says that if a deduction is disallowed for distortion, substantial distortion of income, resulting from the taxpayer's use of a proscribed accounting method, that is a TMT. Not just every substantial distortion of income, only those resulting from the taxpayer's use of a proscribed accounting method. Now, the problem with that is the partnership isn't a taxpayer for these purposes. It's never been interpreted that way in the code. A partnership is a pass-through entity. The taxpayer is the individual partner, and no discussion or no consideration of the partner's accounting method causing the substantial distortion of income is considered here. That is much like the analysis in Copeland, where the decision talks about a disallowance under 183 being a tax-motivated transaction, but only applicable to transactions by individuals or C-corporations, not transactions by partnerships. And therefore, the 183 ruling in Krauss was held not to constitute a TMT in Copeland in this circuit. The second part of that analysis in the decision, of that stipulation in the decision, is to a substantial distortion of income, but not one that constitutes a TMT by statute and by regulation. So there you have then two grounds set forth in the decision, one a TMT, one not a TMT. And under those circumstances, you come right back to Wiener's analysis that where you have a disallowance on mixed independent grounds, that penalty interest is inappropriately applied because of the formula. So what we are saying as to that issue in Duffy is simply that you need to look at whether or not that second ground is a TMT. If it is not, then the same analysis should apply the controlled in Wiener. Going on then with the 7422H analysis, I'd like to then go to how it applies to the limitations issues in all other cases. Deciding whether 7422H, well, let me give another reason.
Is this the 51 issue?
Pardon?
Is this the issue of whether the IRS brought the case soon enough?
That's part of it.
Because there's two limitations issues.
Yes, Your Honor, there.
Claim soon enough, and whether the IRS brought the underlying partnership claim and partner claim soon enough.
And there's also a question of whether or not the refund claim was filed timely, which
right,
is a limitation. Yeah. Let's talk about 7422H itself, just purely for a second. 7422H, by its absolute pure language, says it applies to partnership items. When the code, especially TEFRA, wants to refer to both partnership items and affected items, it does. It specifically enumerates both. And in fact, one of the code sections that's relied upon in Irvine is 6230D1 that I'll note in 97, the court amended it to take out the reference to affected items. It's clear that Congress had absolute meaning when it used those terms. It was either one or both, but it never uses partnership item to include the term affected item or a non-partnership item. Based on that pure analysis of 7422H, for one thing, it cannot bar a refund claim attributable to the penalty interest issue, which everybody agrees is an affected item. What it can do is bar you from relitigating the merits of the transaction at the partnership level. But it can't bar the claim. And in theory, the way TEFRA works and should work and was articulated way back in, I think it was Affiliated Equipment 25 years ago by the tax court, is that partnership items are determined solely at the partnership level, no question. In a partner-level proceeding, the court can make any new partner-level determinations necessary to the case, and it applies the decisions that have been made at the partner level. It has to, otherwise it makes no sense. It cannot make de novo determinations at the partnership level, and it cannot revise those determinations. But that is the system under which TEFRA is designed to work. And anything that has both a partnership item element to it and a non-partnership item element is an affected item. It's a composite of the two. As to penalty interest, it's clear. And everybody throughout these cases acknowledges it is an affected item. Thus, I contend it can't be barred by 7422H. And Duffy is correct. What you do is you go in, you look at what the TMT determination, what the partnership level determinations were, apply them, make an independent determination as to the partner level issues. The problem, and we think they got it right, where we start getting into a problem with it is, what do you do then when we start talking about statute of limitations? The government argues that statute of limitations is purely a partnership item, but it can't be. I mean, Kirspec made that absolutely clear. You have to look at both issues related to the partnership and to the partner. Now, I agree. You can't redetermine the partnership level issues in the partner level case, but 7422H does not bar a 6501 statute of limitations claim. It clearly, as with penalty interest, limits what can be considered in that claim to only the partner level facts and anything previously determined at
the... Practically speaking, how is this ever going to work? If they go after a partnership to establish whatever they want to establish at the partnership level, what TEFRA contemplates, and that takes time. It seems like all this stuff takes time. And we're dealing with a 1985 tax return. I wasn't even a licensed attorney then. So this has been a long time. Then, so that takes time. Meanwhile, you've got these partners kind of hanging out. They're aware of the case. Now that's resolved in favor of the government. Now they want to come and get the benefit of that from the partners, and you're going to say, 6051, we're done.
Okay, Your Honor, I can answer that very easily.
501.
That was a problem prior to 1997. The 1997 amendments amended the code to permit the partners to come into the TEFRA proceeding and raise the statute of limitations issue. And, in fact, Kirspec, being a post-97 case, held that the partners had had that duty, had that responsibility, and should have done it. The difference is prior to 1997, that rule didn't exist. Congress hadn't amended it. And, in fact, Congress had enacted 6226, I think it's D1, but one of the subsections of 6226 that specifically says a partner whose statute of limitations has run may not be a party, may not participate in the partnership level statute or partnership level case. That was amended in 97. But for the years in issue, we are looking at a code that says if these partners' statute of limitations had run, they could not come into the case, they could not participate, and that leaves only the potential of raising it post-assessment, post-TEFRA. I agree. It's awkward. Congress agreed. It's awkward. Congress amended that in 97, but we're not dealing...
But it depends on what your definition of it is. Okay. If you're saying it is these limitations as against the partnership, I'm not bothered by that because there's a forum for that and it was decided. If you're saying these guys get to await the result of the partnership and then say, now it's too late to come after us, it will always have been too late, regardless of what forum you can raise it in, because this stuff seems to take longer than 3 years.
It always does.
It takes 28 years.
Well, it shouldn't take that long, but it does always take. In fact, it's part of the reason I will not.
1985 was 28 years ago.
Your Honor, it's part of the reason I won't take on a new TEFRA case up front. I turned 70 a month ago, and I'm about to retire, and I won't make that kind of a commitment anymore. But let me answer. There is an answer to your question. First, as to the overall dilemma of how this works, I think Congress addressed that in 97, but it didn't resolve the problem for prior years. Additionally, and in the same vein, there's another issue here. The IRS knows, the government knows, when it's involved in a TEFRA case, whether or not it is going to try to assert or is going to rely on an extension of the statute of limitations because the FPAW wasn't issued within the original 3 years or, you know, whatever, for whatever reason. It knows. And 50 years of precedent in this court has held that it is the government's responsibility and duty to raise and prove up an extension of the 6501 3-year statute of limitations. Therefore, what the government should have done in these cases is, if it was asserting an extension of the statute of limitations, it should have established that at the partnership level, if it's an extension under TEFRA, if it's 6229. The problem with Wiener was that we, the taxpayers, and I was counsel in Wiener. On a lot
what
of TEFRA.
Do without you?
I was counsel in Copeland, too. Amicus, as a matter of fact. The problem back then was we didn't have CURSPEC. And we and the government were both assuming 6229 was, in fact, an independent statute of limitations, which the burden would be on the taxpayer to prove. And we couldn't come in after the TEFRA proceeding and seek to prove it. Now, we made arguments for why we felt we should have been able to, since we were barred by 6226, but the court said no. Well, bottom line is, I agree 6229 is a partnership-level issue. It's a partnership-level item, and it has to be determined at the partnership level. But so what happens then when we have an assessment? What happens when we have a partnership that the FPAW is issued 6 years late, and it goes through the tax court, and there's a determination of adjustments? If the burden is on the taxpayer to establish there was no exception, does that mean that from now on, every taxpayer in a TEFRA case must go into the partnership-level proceeding and raise every possible extension the government may wish to rely on and disprove them? If so, we now have a completely unfunctional judicial system. For all of the years that this court has held that it's the government's responsibility to establish an extension to the statute of limitations, that line of cases, which is binding precedent in this circuit, should be applied to an extension of 6501, whether it arises under 6501 or arises under 6229.
What part, if any, does our decision in Scott play here?
Your Honor, I haven't reviewed Scott itself in so long, to be honest.
I mean, it's an unpublished decision, but it's 2011. And, all right.
I don't think it directly addresses these issues. I mean, that's my recollection of it. I regret that I'm not prepared to give you a better answer than that. And by the way, that issue of the precedent of extensions being a defense that it's up to the government to raise has been established in this court in Wood, Arms, J.H. Rutter, Rex, and Payne going back 50 years and as recently as 10 years ago. It has never been considered, it's never been addressed in any of the courts as to why that doesn't apply to the government raising a 6229 defense. And I note that in the briefing in this case, the government has now also fallen back and said, well, wait a minute, the FPAW's even alleged fraud. Fraud would make a 6-year statute of limitations. Why doesn't that apply? Well, for a lot of reasons. Number one, the burden of proof on fraud has always been on the government, independent of whether or not it's an extension. And we have an integrated decision in these cases in which there is no mention whatsoever of an extension based on fraud. But you still have the same problem. Can the government now, at this late date, say we want to rely on an issue that we did not pursue and obtain a ruling on in the partnership level proceeding, just because we once said it might apply? That's the effect that not treating 6229 as a defense that the government must raise has. And I submit that if that issue critically needs to be addressed for purposes of making the TEFRA partnership law work. And it's the only approach that is really consistent with the Fifth Circuit precedent in Kurzbeck, Wood, Armes, J.H. Rutter-Rex, Payne, Alexander, Duffy, Regas. It's never been addressed quite in that context. But if you treat the assessment statute of limitations as an affected item, and by definition it has to be, it is not a partnership item. It can't be determined solely at the partnership level. It is not solely, as the government argues, a partner-level determination. It's mixed bag. The two work in tandem, 6501 and 6229. But every extension of 6501 works in tandem with 6501. That argument doesn't dispose of the precedent in this circuit as to extensions. And I believe this whole issue first requires a determination of what is the statute of limitations? Is it an affected item? Is it, as we believe Kurzbeck clearly holds, an issue that has both elements in it? It's there. Again, Your Honor, to come back to part of your question and the reason we argued 6229 the way we originally did in Wiener was that for about 20 years, the tax court had treated 6229 as if it was an independent statute of limitations. It clarified and reversed itself, I believe it was in Roan-Polnick, and the government's litigating position was announced to be, as the interpretation I've asserted now, that it is not a separate statute of limitations. Every court since then has ultimately held that it's an extension to 6501. But no court has looked at what does that mean in terms of who has the burden of proving it and where it should be established.
Does Wiener foreclose your argument that the settlements converted the statute of limitations issue to a non-partnership item?
No, actually the Wiener court held that the settlement had not converted that particular issue, and that therefore it was still the statute of limitations issue remained, the 6229 statute of limitations remained a partnership item that it could not review. And the only difference, the only problem we have is we would modify Wiener as Kurzbeck did, saying that the reference to it as a statute of limitations in Wiener was merely dicta and it was a misreference. Kurzbeck's very clear on that. It reinterprets what Wiener was doing. And it says that a 6229 determination is a partnership item and cannot be reconsidered in a partner-level case. Wiener held that that was an issue that wasn't converted. We had argued differently. We still think that those should have been treated as integrated settlements, completely settling all issues in the case. But I agree, if it wasn't, if 6229 was to be tried to be pled and argued independently in the case in Wiener, it was barred by 7422H, because 6229 itself is in fact a partnership item. But it's not a statute of limitations. It's a defense to the statute of limitations, and it should have been on behalf of the government established at the partnership level, but it wasn't. Your Honor, I think the next most significant thing to get to is And this is fairly new, virtually a completely new issue in these two sets of cases. The application of the 6230 C2A 6-month statute of limitations for filing a refund claim. It was first addressed by Duffy in Wiener. It was first addressed by Duffy. In Duffy, however, if you carefully read the case, what the court said was that that 6-month filing statute applied to the portion of the claim interpreted as asserting the $1,000 threshold was erroneously computed. It did not apply that 6-month filing statute. It did not dismiss the entire claim because the claim wasn't filed within 6 months. It dismissed as to the computational issue. And there's a reason for that, and there's a reason it should be that closely parsed. The 6230C provides that a partner may file a claim for refund on the grounds that, and under the grounds that the Secretary erroneously computed any computational adjustment necessary. That's not a superfluous duplication of terminology. Erroneously computed has meaning. It means they mathematically erred in the computation of the liability. It does not mean they imposed the liability in a totally unjustified way. If the claim is computational in nature, then it's subject to the 6-month statute. And it's the reason, as I read Duffy, Duffy went in and made the determination, was there a TMT at the partnership level? Because it treated that part of the claim as timely. It wasn't subject to the 6-month statute. It wasn't an erroneous computation. And I can further emphasize the significance of that by noting that it is subsection C. There are three types of claims under C. One is the erroneous computation issue, which this does not fit. The second is that the Secretary failed to allow a refund that results from the proceeding. That doesn't apply. That's not the nature of these claims by any means. The third is the Secretary erroneously imposed any penalty, addition to tax, or additional amount. Now, that third one might, in fact, be applicable to a penalty interest claim now, but that was enacted in 1997 for post-97 years. 6621C did not even apply to that nature of a claim, that type of a claim. So it didn't apply. It doesn't apply to a claim on the grounds, and that's the key, is to determine if those three sections apply, you look at the grounds stated in the refund claim, not how the original computation was made.
So if that 6230 statute of limitations doesn't apply, which one does apply?
That's a good question, prior to 97. I think there are several possible answers to that. One is, first, as I've said, 7422H does not by its terms bar a refund claim attributable to an affected item. The legislative history to TEFRA's original enactment specifically says that if a partner has actually overpaid his taxes, he can file that refund claim under the normal 6511 two-year statute of limitations, but not a claim, quote, attributable to a partnership item, not affected item. So we have always argued that the normal two-year statute should apply. The government has argued, and the court below looked at 6230D1-6, that says the normal limitations periods don't apply to claims do not apply to claims attributable to a partnership item or an affected item. That was amended in 97 to remove the affected item language. But prior to 97, it creates an ambiguity. What is the appropriate statute of limitations? If it's not the two-year statute, and at least one district court in this circuit has held that it still is, but if it's not, then you fall back to two other possibilities. 6230D1 says the limitations period, maximum limitations period, is the period during which the liability could be assessed. Now, as to penalty interest, interest can be assessed for up until 1 year after the decision and for 10 additional years after the tax is assessed. So we would have had 11-year statute of limitations under that to raise the 6621C claims. Alternatively, if that's not the applicable statute, then I think you would fall back on the general federal statute, and it would be 6 years from the date the cause of action arose. So it doesn't leave you void, but it does not say that every claim is subject only to the limitations period in 6230C, because those apply only to claims on certain grounds. And none of the claims in these cases are based on those grounds. Your Honor, I'm about to run out of time. Are there any questions?
You've saved time for rebuttal. Thank you, Mr. Reed.
And I will on rebuttal address the special Kircher issue, if I may.
All right.
But it's been briefed thoroughly.
Okay.
Thank you.
All right, Ms. Hauser.
Good morning, Your Honor. This is a complicated case. TEFRA is a very complicated statute, not merely because it's very complicated, but because it is in many ways counterintuitive. So things we assume are baseline standards don't work quite the same way in TEFRA, and that's because TEFRA is intentionally violating two unities we're familiar with from litigation. One is that a whole nucleus of operative facts will be determined in one place, and the other is that one taxpayer, one tax year is a cause of action. TEFRA violates both of those in order to determine partnership items at the partnership level. Now, and it created an extremely complicated procedure for doing that. It would have been totally unjustified had the world not been coping with extremely complicated partnership litigation before that, which was all ad hoc and often had inconsistent results and people falling through cracks. The general procedure with TEFRA determinations is that the partnership return determines the partnership item. If the IRS issues an FPA, Final Partnership Administrative Adjustment, then the FPA controls the partnership item. After that, if a taxpayer settles the item, enters a settlement with the IRS, the settlement controls, but as this court held in Weiner, only for the items specifically mentioned in the settlement. If they're not mentioned in the settlement, you look back to the partnership level, to the FPA, or if there's no FPA, to the original return. And, of course, if there's a partnership level proceeding, then the result in the partnership level proceeding is what controls. With that structure in mind, I'd like to turn first to the 6501 statute of limitations issue. That issue concerns the Varellas, the Kirchers, the Irvines, and the Whites, but I believe not Mr. Kramer. And all the courts handled this issue first because if the taxes were untimely assessed, then there's no need to reach any of the further issues. And here, again, we see TEFRA severing the unity of these closely connected ideas, the 6501 statute of limitations on assessment and 6229 extension of that statute of limitations. It's very clear that the base three-year 6501A statute of limitations is a partner item because it depends on when the partner filed his return. It's what starts that clock running. The 6229 extension of that period is a partnership item. It depends on, starts running when the partnership files its return, and then it can be extended by some partnership issues and then by some other things that can be done by individual partners. For example, an individual partner can agree to extend the time in which to assess taxes attributable to partnership items. But at the end of the day, this relationship is very simple. 6229 period, if it is still open, holds open the 6501 period. And some of the theoretical complexity surrounding this issue, I think, is sort of particularly difficult to get a grasp on because the underlying issue is so simple. If 6229 is open, 6501 is open, and it's almost it becomes almost impossible to see that there's even an issue about whether 6501 is open if you know that 6229 is open. This was decided by this court in Weiner, which looked at the 6229 issue and concluded that it had held open the periods. Kirspec did not change that analysis. Kirspec, as we explained in our brief, dealt with a very unusual circumstance where some of the partners had carried partnership losses forward to future tax years so that their partnership return was filed before the partner return. The 6229 period that starts with the partnership return had closed, but though for those partners, the 6501A period was still open because it had been less than 3 years since they filed their partner-level returns. This court in Kirspec held that 6229 could only extend and never shorten the 6501A period. So even though it was more than 3 years since the 6229, since the partnership return had been filed, this partnership issues could still be addressed because they were still relevant to taxes which still had open years. We explained to this court in Kirspec that we did not believe that starting the partnership level proceeding in Kirspec would reopen the years for partnerships for partners whose tax years had closed, and we continue to stand by that position. But this case doesn't have that because we don't have this oddity where the partnership years are separate from the partner years. And also because the 6229 period remained open. The fact that the 6229 period was open was determined by the FPAWS. And again, the FPAWS is not merely a pleading in court. If it's not later altered, the FPAWS is determinative. Some of those issues were addressed by the tax court in AgriCal, and we detailed in our brief exactly which holdings in AgriCal apply to which partnerships at issue here. Holdings in AgriCal were incorporated into the tax court decisions in Kircher and Varela. There's also a sort of previous issue here, which is whether we should even be looking at whether the 6229 period has been determined, whether that's a partnership item that cannot be reached. Now, Mr. Redding has argued that I'm not sure how to operationalize his distinction between partnership items and affected items. This court in Duffy explained that an affected item has a partnership component and a partner-level component, and all the partnership components are barred from being from litigation under 7422H. So clearly the 6229 issues in this case were partnership-level components. They should be barred by 7422H unless we come within the 6230C exception, which is the six-month exception. The forms 4549A here, which are the notices of computational adjustment and start the running of that six-month period, I think are clearly sufficient to give the taxpayers notice of the assessment of additional tax, and therefore that should start the six-month period running for that. If there are no other questions on the 65, are there any questions about 6501? Before I move on to the 6621C interest issue, this issue affects all five taxpayers. If a taxpayer to win this one, I think it's worth pointing out that they would get back only some of the interest that was assessed and paid because, of course, 6621C is enhanced interest, but the absence of enhanced interest still leaves ordinary interest. And again, here, as this court explained in Duffy, TEFRA has partitioned what looks like a single tax item, 6621C interest, into partnership-level components and partner-level components. The partnership component is whether this is a tax-motivated transaction. The partner-level component is whether there was...
And you would agree in Irvine, if in the Irvine group, I guess I should say, if they, if we can look under 7422H whether there was a TMT determination, and if they can overcome your concerns about the timeliness of their refund, then they win on the enhanced interest.
Yes.
Okay.
We agree. That's, it's the same fact pattern as Weiner.
But it's a different analysis with Kircher because they didn't settle.
That's right. And the Weiner settlement agreements are we are not arguing that they're distinguishable from these. The district court held that they were not entitled to the refund because they didn't get their claim in time, a preliminary issue that was not addressed in Weiner.
Right. Okay.
In that regard, Mr. Redding has been suggesting that the six-month determination in Duffy referred only to the partner-level item, the $10,000 threshold. But the taxpayers in Duffy were not contesting that the $10,000 threshold, or I'm sorry, the $1,000 threshold, slight difference there, was was exceeded. I would like to point out with regard to the Irvine Group, and we're not challenging that Weiner controls here, I'd just like to point out that the IRS did make a sham determination in the FPAW. There was a sham determination there, and that had the IRS not gone on to make additional determinations, even under Weiner, that would have been sufficient to impose the interest, and that at the time the interest was imposed, Weiner had not yet been decided, so that it was imposing interest on the basis of the law as it understood it at the time. As I just mentioned, of course, the district court in Irvine denied the deductions because the refund claims, the administrative refund claims, were not filed within 6 months of the notice of computational adjustment, as is required by 6230C. The computational the notices of computational adjustment here were adequate to inform the taxpayers that the interest would be imposed, computed at the enhanced rate. The notices in the Irvine group give estimated interest amounts without an exact final amount. Of course, it's in the nature of interest that it cannot be exactly and finally computed until the payment is finally made. And the ones in Kircher and Varela simply indicated the interest would be made, and it did say on the forms that the amount due was 0.00. However, taxpayers have been relying on a case called McGann out of the Court of Federal Claims, which suggested that was insufficient to start the clock running. That seems inconsistent with Duffy, although it doesn't say it in the Duffy opinion on the facts of Duffy. That was also a 0.00 case. And also, of course, the recent Federal Circuit decision in Bush indicated that similar notices of computational adjustment with that 0.0 figure was sufficient for the same reason given in Duffy, that it, the notice notified the taxpayer of the rate at which interest would be imposed. I just, in passing, like to emphasize what Judge Haynes said about the length of time it takes to resolve these questions. I believe that's the reason for the six-month statute. Once
we've really blown past that.
there are a lot of things that caused a lot of delays in that this case, but part of what caused the delays was the taxpayers, almost uniformly, although possibly not all of them, waiting out the entire two-year period after finishing making the payment to file an administrative refund claim. So that, obviously, that doesn't account for the entire matter, but it pushes it a little bit farther, and that pulling that limitation back from 2 years to 6 months in these cases, I think, is Congress's way of...
I think it speed up the 28 years.
Well, it would have given you 18 months in a number of these cases. That might not be material compared to 28 years.
I don't know.
Part of the a lot of the delay in some of these cases is that the IRS does not believe there is a statute of limitations. Once the refund claim is filed, if the IRS doesn't deny it, it can be brought at any time. A case in court can be brought at any time, and that accounts for a certain amount of the delay here. With regard to the alleged existence of an amended return, a 1040X in Kircher, again, this is an issue that the district court resolved on the basis of the six-month statute, and that was an appropriate decision because the taxpayer's complaint is based on the way the IRS applied the partnership items to the partner. Notice of computational adjustment, again, gave the partner notice, that Mr. Kircher noticed, that of the amounts that the IRS was assessing. And as we've argued further in our brief, the IRS was not obliged to issue a notice of deficiency here because the IRS was not asserting that there was any deficiency attributable to individual partner items. And the cases, the Scar and Weller cases that Mr. Kircher relies upon are not applicable here because they concern situations where the IRS did not look at the taxpayer's individual file. Here, the IRS took into consideration everything it had in the file. And Portillo is not consistent with taxpayers' argument. Taxpayers are arguing that there's something missing. In Portillo, the IRS couldn't produce a document, and it was held to have the burden of proof with respect to that document. But here, the taxpayers are arguing for the existence of a document, as opposed to in Portillo, the taxpayer was arguing that the document did not exist or was not accurate. Mr. Redding has also argued that the tax court decisions in Varela and Kircher should be interpreted through the lens of Krauss, but as the Federal Circuit very recently held, Krauss was distinguishable from these cases in that it was a direct appeal from the tax court decisions at issue in that case, and the taxpayer should not be allowed to collaterally attack it in this one. If there are no more questions, the government rests on its briefs.
Thank you, Ms. Hauser. Mr. Redding, you've saved some time for rebuttal.
Your Honor, with regard to the special issue in Kircher about the naked assessment, it was not our argument that Portillo and Scar directly controlled that, but ultimately that the principles did, that where we have a situation where the government knows it cannot accurately compute the liability and automatically makes the assessment, that is naked assessment, especially where, as here under TEFRA, there is a special provision in the code that says under those circumstances a notice of deficiency should have been issued, and they did not issue it. The failure to issue that required statutory notice of deficiency itself renders the assessment void and invalid. And the very purpose of that, and if it has no other purpose, where does it apply? Here we have a record that says the government reviewed its files. It knew it didn't have adequate information to accurately compute the liability. Its own records indicated it believed that income averaging had been used on the amended return that it couldn't locate. I would reference the court to basically our argument on that starting at page 45 in our reply brief, or 43 in our reply brief, because as it summarizes there, here's what the government knew. It knew that Kircher had filed an amended return. The government says that's not clear. It is, and the documents are in the record to establish that. It did not have a complete, it knew it didn't have a complete copy of the amended return. It had asked Kircher for a copy. He was able to provide only the first page. It knew its computations for this purpose were not even consistent with the original return or the portion of the amended return it had. It knew, and its own notes in the administrative file indicate that it knew, that income apparently used income averaging on his amended 85 return. It could have looked back at his 82, 3, and 4 taxable income, which it had in its records as well, to perhaps do an income averaging computation. It didn't. Under those circumstances, it's our position that under the code, under 6230A, the code provides that the IRS was required to issue a notice of deficiency, giving the taxpayer the opportunity, just as it would have had in any other deficiency case normally, to petition the tax court and ask for reconsideration and to prove up all of these issues. We never got to that stage. The government says, well, you didn't come in and prove it up. Well, we never got to that point. We never got the notice of deficiency. And the courts have consistently held that failure is fatal to the government, and that's the basis of the claim. Your Honor, on several other points that were raised, I'd like to just briefly address them. Your Honor, when you asked me about Scott, I apologize. I think of that case by its name, Matthews.
It's district court case.
Yeah.
Name, sure.
Clearly, why shouldn't it apply? Number one, because it's not a published opinion, neither by the trial court nor by this court, and I think is therefore not binding precedent. And ultimately, what that court interpreted the claim as being was our request that Wiener be overturned. And that's not the issue here. We're not asserting that Wiener should be overturned in any way, shape, or form. We're not arguing that Wiener was wrong. We are arguing that Kirspeck, as Kirspeck interprets Wiener, it is correct that 6229 is a partnership item. The question now is, who has the burden of bringing it up and proving it? We think it's the government. In Wiener, we argued it as if it was our burden, our obligation, which the court held we couldn't do in Wiener. And we agree. Your Honor, as to the issue of the settlements being comprehensive or non-comprehensive, that's been briefed. Clearly, the government represented to the tax court and to the partners that they were settling all matters and they would no longer be parties to the proceeding. In that regard, we really don't agree with Wiener, but we're not asking that that be reconsidered because we don't think it's really germane. We think Wiener is applicable and it is correct on penalty interest. As to... Again, I will come back and say, as to the 6229 being the government's burden to prove and why that doesn't make TEFRA basically unworkable, the government knows when it issues an FPAW that is depending upon a 6229 extension at the partnership level, when it knows that it's looking at a partnership level extension to the statute of limitations, it knows that. And it should go ahead and preserve that determination. It didn't do it. And it didn't do it partly because we all misinterpreted what 6229 was back then. Agriquel, the opinion in Agriquel was never incorporated into these decisions. The cases in issue in this court were not consolidated under Agriquel. The decisions that were entered in the tax court were based on a settlement between the TMP and the Internal Revenue Service. They specifically did not integrate the prior Agriquel decision, nor the terms of the FPAW. They stand alone. And the decisions that were entered in those cases should be reviewed strictly on the merits of the decisions. As in Duffy, we ask that you look at the language in the unsettled partners, look at the language in the decision, and is that a TMT or isn't it? And that's should be sufficient to resolve the issue. Under the 6230C, 3-year statute of limitations, my first argument, my best argument, is that it shouldn't apply at all because our our claims do not are not based on the grounds covered by that section. If you get past that, then the question is what constitutes a sufficient notice of computational adjustments. It's not defined in the code. It is unclear. Bush does not say that it's the 4549. Bush looks at what, well, we don't know whether it was the 4549. We don't know if it was the assessment. Maybe the IRS should have assumed it when it paid the liability. Varela, I believe, came down and in that case held the 4549s weren't sufficient. McCann said they weren't sufficient to start the statute running. We think that's the correct ruling. If the court gets there. I don't think the court should have to get there. I would disagree with the government. If you look back at the FPAWS in these cases, the term sham isn't in there. A series of transactions lacking economic substance is, if you interpret that as sham, then yes. But again, you have a mixed FPAW with, I think it was something over 12 different grounds for disallowance, most of which are not TMTs. Wiener says if you look at that and you apply the formula under the Treasury regulation, which has the weight of law, that penalty interest doesn't apply, and Wiener should control. And it is binding precedent in this circuit. I would like to take a moment, Your Honor, and just try to address these on a broad concept, and then I'll just leave it to the court. I want to hit what I considered really to be the motivating issues for me in these cases. One, if following a TEFRA decision or a settlement, the IRS assesses a liability as a computational adjustment, but there's no justification for that assessment in the decision or in the settlement, where and how can the taxpayer seek to correct that? Is he always limited to this draconian 6230C 6 months from limitations, or 6 months from NCA, from Notice of Computational Adjustments? And let's look at how draconian that section is. The government has a year after the settlement or the finality of the decision to assess the liability. At any time during that time, it can issue an NCA, but it's not even required to at all. If they issue the NCA 60 days into that year and they don't assess until 300 days into that year, how does the taxpayer pay that and file a claim for refund within 6 months of the NCA? He can't. Even worse, what if we have a taxpayer who can't come up with the liquidity to pay it that quickly or is completely unable? I actually have a case in my office that I will be writing to the service about when I just lost my time.
Your time has expired, Mr.
Oh, I thought I had like 5 minutes left. I'm sorry.
We have 40 minutes left.
Yes. May I finish that last comment, please?
You may quickly, yes.
I actually have a case in my office right now where the IRS in 2005 adjusted a $10,000 investment with a $5,000 deduction, denied the $5,000 deduction. As a computational adjustment, it then issues a notice for 97, or for 2007, 5 years later, or several years later, in which it holds that a $164,000 passive loss carryover is being denied because of that earlier partnership item adjustment and assessed $70,000 as a computational adjustment to a man living on Social Security who cannot pay it. Now, if 6230C is the controlling statute on that, it ought to be unconstitutional. And I think, frankly, somewhere along the line, it's going to get tested.
All right. Your time
has expired
now, Mr. Redding. Your case and all of today's cases are under